Hello there and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, where this week we take our mics on journeys from Pimlico to the Rialto, Sicily to Chicago. Coming up this time, Ireland in Venice introduces the idea of cob housing to the art world. There's activist football in inner city Dublin and a celebration of the poetry and punk of Lydia Tomku. But we begin on a hillside above the sparkling sea. The Greek Amphitheatre at Syracuse in Sicily last showed up on Culturefile in Ferdia Lennon's debut novel Glorious Exploits, in which it's the inspiration for an imaginary production of a drama by Euripides performed by Athenian captives. This week, that Greek theatre, its seating cut into a hillside looking across the Mediterranean in the 3rd century BCE, is a setting for a non-imaginary production of Euripides' telling of the tragedy of Phaedra. The show is directed by Paul Curran, most famous for creating operas at a where's where of the big international houses, from Covent Garden to La Scala, and indeed Wexford Festival Opera. For Phaedra, Curran is taking a sidestep into drama for a chance to put on a show at a spot in which the likes of Aeschylus and Euripides showcased new work. Culturefile met up with Curran at a sound test in the amphitheatre.
This is our Phaedra, Alessandra Salamida, who's doing a sound test with the actions of the stage, just to see if the wind picks up on the mic, which it always does.
That's open air theatre for you, though.
Open air theatre for you when I say that.
It's kind of amazing to be working here. I mean, any house you go to, there's a kind of, you know, a legend and whatever went before. But here, because of this sort of ancient theatrical tradition, it must be an extraordinary place to work.
Well, I mean, we're walking in a place that Archimedes walked in. I mean, you know, if you even go back to the 18th century, Lord Byron came here. But Archimedes came here. That blows my mind. And there's 5,000 seats. It's kind of amazing. So, I think it's a challenge. It's not an easy space, but it's fantastic.
This is Gaia Aprea. Salve, come stai cara? Inizio.
Perché appena entro in scena passa, però c'è un momento prima, che...
Yeah, I mean, Italian, I'm very lucky. I learned Italian in high school in Scotland. So that was quite extraordinary, really, to learn it. And I knew, I remember at the time, they said, oh no, you got to study chemistry because boys do chemistry and girls do languages. And I was like, well, I'm sure there's a lot of boys in Italy that actually speak Italian. So if that's the story, this girl's doing Italian. And it's given me a career ever since, the languages. So we're sitting, we're on cushions, thank God, but we're on stones that were carved out, it was actually 2,500 years ago that they carved this out of the rock. But here we are, it's an extraordinary acoustic, it's a really incredible space. If anybody that's listening hasn't seen this space, well, you know, while we're talking, look up the internet. It's a really beautiful, special place. As a director, I honestly try not to look at anybody else's shows. A couple of friends have done shows here, other directors, so I looked at theirs because I don't want to be overly influenced. But the one thing I do want to do always is to see what the space is, whether that's the little theatre in Wexford or Bourgosh or wherever. I want to see the space and feel the space. So it was important. I came here a year ago. Gary McCann and I came here. He's the designer, Irishman designer. Came here a year ago and we saw the space. And what we learned was this space needs to be kind of quite open so that you can see the entirety of the event. And a part of the set, shall we say, becomes the actors. So the actors really fill the space, rather than filling it with, it'd be easy to fill it with a massive big construction.
One of the things that people know about you is from your opera, but this isn't actually an opera, so this is a little sidestep for you.
Well, it's not really a sidestep, actually. It's back to my roots. I was a dancer first, many years and many, many kilos ago, and I'm now no longer a dancer, obviously. But actually, I trained at drama school, so I went to drama school in Australia. And I trained as a director of drama, really. So, and then because I spoke languages, I'm a bit of a polyglot. I all of a sudden was getting offered operas everywhere. I never imagined that would be my career, but it has been my career. So it's been fabulous to come back to a play and a really fantastic, delicious text like this one.
You worked with Baz Luhrmann in Sydney Opera. I mean, is that what dragged you into opera?
Oh, no, that was not what dragged me into opera. But I did work with Baz. Baz was an extraordinarily fantastic, generous and kind boss to work for. I worked for him for 2 years on a Midsummer Night's Dream at the Australian Opera. No, opera, I got the passion for opera when I was 15 and I saw my first opera, which was Wozzeck by Alban Berg. I thought it was so extraordinary that I ended up going to see all six shows.
We've just seen a little bit from the production here. You obviously have introduced a sort of strong musical element into this, even though it's just a spoken text generally.
It's a spoken text, but a lot of it in the Hellenistic era, the Greek era, would have actually been sung. So what we've done is we've taken certain elements, and what you just saw and heard is the funeral. I've put in a funeral march.
You have a bit of a reputation for that, like making the little change in the canon if it's necessary.
Well, all these composers and writers did that themselves, didn't they? They all made little changes. They all developed the art forward. If we don't rethink, if we don't sort of think what else can we add to help explain the story better, then it's going to die because it's just a museum. It just becomes a museum piece. And I'm not interested in seeing something under glass. I don't really care who did what and when. I care about what this audience tonight is going to see.
Director Paul Curran there at the Greek Theatre in Syracuse, Sicily. The 60th edition of the Venice Biennale is underway, one of the biggest global gatherings of artists, worried about things like big global gatherings of artists. Many of this year's participants address this paradox and have been finding ways to ease their impact, not least of which is Ireland's contributor Emma Walsh, whose work thinks through construction, capitalism and the housing crisis in Ireland. Orit Gat also gathered in Venice to gather her latest voice notes for Culture File.
The Venice Biennale is made up of two elements. The first is an international show, this year organized by Brazilian curator Adriano Pedrosa, entitled Foreigners Everywhere. The second is made up of national pavilions, where different countries take up buildings or parts of buildings throughout Venice, each presenting an exhibition that attempts to highlight contemporary artistic creation in that nation. The USA Pavilion this year is by Indigenous artist Jeffrey Gibson, who is of Choctaw and Cherokee heritage. Egypt's much-admired pavilion is one video work by Wael Shawky, Drama 1882, about a nationalist uprising in 1882 that was crushed by the British, who then colonized Egypt until 1956. And Vlatko Horvat moved into the building that houses the Croatian Pavilion for the next 8 months. She asked other artists to send works to display in the pavilion by handing them over to people who are traveling through Venice or Croatia to carry over. Not a single work was shipped, and the journey the works travel and the meetings between the often strangers who couriered them are documented, catalogued, and become part of the exhibition. Ireland's pavilion this year, titled Romantic Ireland, displays the work of Emer Walsh. Set in a huge, raw brick room, the visitors sit on a sculpture. Benches made in the rammed earth construction method, covered with green cushioned seats. In front of them are six video screens, three on each side, set up on a long plinth, also made in rammed earth. The videos show a group of people building a cob house. They wear masks and very different clothes as they represent figures from the 19th century to the present day, addressing the history of the Land Acts and up to the contemporary housing crisis. The soundtrack is an opera composed by Amanda Fieri, who invited Walsh to write the libretto. Walsh's text is about an eviction, but not only. As it touches on personal lives, it makes up a political and social history, as well as a history of the place. I visit on the last day of the Biennale's preview and catch Sarah Gravo, who is curator of visual arts at Project Art Center in Dublin and curated the pavilion. We step outside of the echoey, dark space into the sunshine to have a chat. It's early, still quiet around the Biennale site. We look at the water, and I ask her about the practicalities of bringing all those video screens on boats into Venice. But then, of course, we end up talking about the work itself. Grevo describes how Welsh, whose pronouns are they, them, made a work that may seem like its subject is historical, but in it...
They speak of and from this precarious generation that is facing into a kind of housing crisis and kind of a foreclosed future somehow in Ireland. It's just like, it's so difficult for young artists to see what the future can be or what it can hold. And somehow this work that addresses a kind of a history, it like reaches back into history and it pulls at threads and pulls things together and creates a kind of a way that we can see ourselves in the past, but maybe can also see a different future for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. The Irish Pavilion is at the very end of the Arsenale, Venice's former shipyard and military arsenal, which houses the large section of the Biennale's international show, along with several national pavilions. When Walsh and I sit down to speak, we make ourselves comfortable on the marble stairs to one of the piers, watching a queue snaking outside the Italian pavilion and looking at birds skimming the water. Where to start? The story in the opera feels rich in detail, the sound intensely tender. The images themselves are haunting to me, though that may be the effect of the masks. I ask Walsh about the earth sculpture and what its relationship to the narrative is. They tell me about how they learned about rammed earth and cob houses.
So much so much narrative inside it, so much history inside it, and so much, it revealed so much about, I suppose, when I was taught about it 2-3 years ago, I was absolutely fascinated that people used to come together, dig clay out of the ground, mix it into a composite, and then spend a long time like impregnating the straw into the clay by dancing on it together in groups, and then building houses for each other.
Wolf says they asked themselves, why not make a cob house today? If they're trying to figure out housing for themselves, surely that could be an option. But the answer to why not is that in the contemporary labor situation, getting 20 friends to take the time off work and build a house together is not feasible. The entire work, Walsh explains, is like a biography of a house. Only its past, present, and future keep intermingling. In the video, the people are basically making a ruin, as contradictory as that may sound. Then the libretto tells the story of an eviction, introducing the past, who lived there, and the uncertain future of the land, of the people forced to leave it. Of course, questions about housing are not only practical, they are intimate questions and they are social questions of value, of history, of how our societies are shaped. They are also, Walsh points out, questions intertwined with colonial history.
That is the remit of my work, and it has been for many years, is trying to depict or narrate or come to a better understanding or analysis of what Ireland is, why it's like this. Those questions are in the front of my mind all of the time, and what's exciting to me about representing Ireland in Venice is that you get to bring those questions to an international conversation, and you get to meet people who are grappling with these same questions in relation to their own nation.
Questions of land are historical, political, and in Venice, also very practical. It's a bit hard to source earth in a city like Venice. It's not in abundance, is how Walsh puts it. To make the sculpture, they worked with a local group called Rebiennale, who repurposed materials from previous biennales. They also designed and built the display for the Croatian pavilion I describe above, made of plywood used 2 years ago. They turned the Belgian pavilion into a gym on Giudecca Island. And Walsh's sculpture is made of clay used for the Brazilian pavilion in last year's architecture biennial, which also won the biennial's award, the Golden Lion. The Venice Biennale is on view through November, but this is not the end of romantic Ireland. Walsh is working on a second part of the libretto, so its story will still grow, and the work itself will travel. They hope that it will tour Ireland, and it is already slated to be displayed in Cardiff at a contemporary art space called Chapter. Like its material, the work is malleable. It could be composed of 3, 6, or 24 screens, and the sculpture itself will be built of local materials each time. What about the Venice sculpture, then? I ask Walsh.
Yeah, we're really looking for somebody who's on the market for a couple of tons of clay.
Orit Gat there in Venice with her latest voice notes. A little while back, poet, DJ and artist Quiva Lavelle made the case on Culture File for the music of Basil Kirchen, getting a little more widespread respect, and this time she welcomes us to the sounds and the sayings of American-born poet, singer and DIY rocker Lydia Tomku.
Any celebrities here tonight?
Lydia Tomku was a Chicago poet born in 1959 to Ukrainian immigrant parents. She is remembered primarily for her band Algebra Suicide, formed in 1982, a post-punk outfit of herself and husband John Heidecker, pairing poetry with angular guitar, drum machine and synth. In her lifetime, she published 6 collections of poetry and was selected by John Ashbery for Best American Poetry Anthology. Could we compare her with another act? Lydia didn't appreciate the many Patti Smith comparisons she received in her time. In spite of having written the lines, "I wanna, I wanna, I wanna, I wanna be like Patti Smith." She much preferred being referred to as a female Lou Reed, or her band described as Joy Division with a sense of humour. My personal comparison is perhaps Emily Dickinson with a rampant social life. Paul Hoover, Tomku's college poetry professor, describes Lydia and her generation of poets as hungry to make an impact and to be famous.
He had a fever in Paris. He danced in Berlin. He collapsed on the stage in London.
One of their goals was to bring about a female beat generation, aspiring to become names as household as O'Hara, Ginsberg, and Ferengetti. Hoover states that this group of talented women poets had no particular poetics or manifesto, but that their work was always earthy, vivid, scandalous, sassy, and deep. Hoover recalls a class assignment in which he asked his students to create a new original poetic format. Lydia presented a poem based on palindromes, 6 of oxes, a form she would return to several times, in Tender Red Net and Off Urge, Gruff O.
Sunny Asian.
That one was actually written, the text part was written in a rondel, which is an archaic poetic form, made famous by Charles de La Salle way back in prehistoric times.
Lydia was particularly passionate about the form of her poetry.
No, really. And I'm not going to go into the rhyme scheme because, or the meters or anything, because I don't remember and I'm sure you don't care.
The formerly playful works are a perfect example of Lydia's more cryptic poetry, painting mysterious images in form. But though her poems can be complex, they will often center on a particular concept which scaffolds the poem and provides an entry point. These concepts include a list of terms for kissing, in What I Like Doing Best, an increasingly fanciful order in a restaurant, in Can I Take Your Order Please?
Also, I know this isn't on the menu, but could the passers-by that are gawking at us through the big windows be gathered to watch our glamorous show, then burst out in a thunderous applause while we make curtain calls and the drapes open and close and we bow and bow again and flowers are thrown at us?
A collection of truisms in which each piece of wisdom contradicts the last.
Because too many cooks spoil the broth and God helps those who help themselves, and if you want something done, do it yourself, but two heads are better than one.
Lydia was a poet's poet, not just in her body of work, but in how she lived her life. She was passionate about decadence.
I don't know about you, but I'm getting pretty sick and tired of like really healthy people telling me about how I'm like doing all these bad things, like drinking and smoking, whatever, and how it's gonna kill me. This next one's for them, it's called Please Respect Our Decadence.
Following the dissolve of Algebra Suicide in 1993, Lydia adapted a more electronic approach for her final solo record, Incorporated.
We girls, we have to mature, create an instant past, a hairline incision into what was once called clunk.
Lydia's musical projects have been consistently appreciated by subsequent generations.
They say we'd lose our heads if they weren't attached to our spines by ganglia and nerve tissue and stuff called effervescent because it's pink.
However, until recently, Lydia's 6 collections of poetry were all out of print until their reproduction in a collection named Poems, edited by Dan Shep-Levy in 2020.
To be ringmasters, bachelorettes of knowledge, and queens of the world.
This has allowed her poetry to be read again outside of the context of her musical projects, rightfully pulling focus to the incision of her wit, her true literary prowess, and even the typographical side of her punk self-presentation. And I promise you, dear listener, that she is every bit as charismatic on the page as she was on the stage.
Father once warned me that I'd explode, and I did.
That was Cuiva Lavelle there on the life and the words of Lydia Tomkew. And finally, this time on the Culture File Weekly, planning for fun in Dublin. Making use of the range of public inner-city football pitches each week is the 1815 Football Club. A big part of the purpose of the club is to ensure that each pitch gets a regular game, to fend off the ceaseless attempts to close these public resources, such as the Michael Mallon pitch behind Dublin's Vicar Street, which is once again being sought as a site for a new hotel. One of those who regularly turns out for the 1815 Football Club is Culturefile reporter Vanessa Noonan, who brought her microphone along recently to make this postcard from midfield.
Hey, Vanessa.
So my name is Vanessa and I am consistently, I'd say, the worst football player on my team when I go play with them every Sunday. I play for 1815 Football Club and every Sunday we play in a different pitch all around Dublin City.
Oh, Turvey Park. That's my favourite pitch.
Really?
Have you been there?
No.
It's really cute.
I love the basin, Blessington Basin.
South Dock Street on a sunny day.
Oh, yeah. I'm new to football in my life. I only started playing football as an adult, maybe when I was 20, was when I first started playing football. Whereas I'm playing with people who've kind of been playing for their whole lives, people who have unbelievable connection to their feet. And it's fine. It works perfectly because the point of 1815 football is not playing a competitive and high-scoring game, but it's about just playing football and being in the different pitches in Dublin City. The football club, for me anyway, has always helped me connect with people in the different pitches because they all attract strangers who want to come and play.
I remember it's in the city centre.
In the
Mountjoy Square. Do you remember? Yeah, here, there. Always, I like to play football, but when I see the guys, I just...
Can I join?
Yeah, of course.
Can I join?
And you rocked it.
And you rocked it.
Oh, yeah.
The different pitches different groups of people who want to come and join in. Like in Mountjoy, there's always, probably in Mountjoy Square when we play there, the biggest amount of people join in. And, you know, it's people... who I maybe wouldn't have that much to chat to about for a couple of hours, but we can hang out for a couple of hours by just spending time playing football together.
Walking tournament. I don't know, it was the last year or 2 years ago. And we went into a penalty shootout and we picked up a couple of Somali ringers at Mountjoy Square. And I was going to go in for the penalty shootout and then one of the Somali guys came up and was like, no, I'm Somali. And then I was like, okay, you know what, it's all yours, you go in. And we lost.
No, did he miss?
he did pretty badly.
And we often play, a lot of the free pitches the city are in front of flats. And the kids will come down and join in and often be very sort of full of themselves. Even if they don't necessarily, well, they're kids, so they don't need to be amazing at football, but they definitely are amazing at the bragging part of football.
One of my favourite pitches is Pimlico.
Mm.
I love the kids there. I think they're really funny. Each pitch has their different kids, and the kids in Pimlico are hilarious.
Do you remember anything they say in particular?
They're kind of just really loud. It's more the volume of the kids, really, as opposed to like what they actually say.
Bobby's with us.
Hey. One, two, three,
I'm Bernardino.
Got the manager as well.
Nice, Bobby. Yeah, he's self-appointed manager.
He's bringing Pele back.
He said he's going to bring us to Champions League.
He's going to bring us to the Champions League. And he's bringing Pele back.
And Premier League.
But I know that a big part of the club's ethos is to kind of use public spaces and make sure they their use is documented and to be part of the fight to keep them open and keep them used. An example of that is our favourite pitch to play on in behind Vickers Street at the Michael Mallon pitch, which a couple of years ago, planning permission was put in for an 8-storey hotel just beside it. And kind of the fear would be that it'd be like the hotel in the Portobello that just got built where it's sort of square in front of it ceases to be a sort of public square and becomes an extension of the hotel itself.
My favourite pitch to play on in Dublin with 1815 would have to be, I think it would have to be Michael Mallon Park.
Vickers Street, no, final answer.
Be Michael Mallon Park.
Michael Mallon Park.
This planning permission been put in again to the Michael Mallon pitch, which really is just, it's maybe the most central pitch in Dublin and has just sort of an amazing vibe to it. And every week when we play there, probably about a different group of maybe 5 or 10 kids always comes and joins us, in particular these two kids. One of them's already turned 18, actually. But they were playing with us for 5 years and changed a lot and became our friends.
The goals just flow. I think, I don't know, it's a... That pitch is charmed.
Local people, Raimundo, Keane, they're my favourites.
Alex and Raimundo.
Legends.
Yeah.
No, it just has a magic quality to it.
And I also love Raimundo. Raimundo lives in one of the flats at Michael Mallon Park. And the first time, he's an iconic football player, and the first time I ever played, he didn't want to play with me because I was a girl. And now we are best friends.
Moving into a new area from Donegal anyway. The Michael Mallon pitch happened to be the one around the corner from my house. And then from playing football there, I started to see some of the people we would play with. I'd run into them and their family on the way to the shop. And it is just a way of meeting people who live near you or live in the same city as you that you don't normally meet or talk to. Keeping public space public is definitely a central belief of the football club anyway. And I know keeping public space that people can use and interact with and be part of and meet other people in is important to the football club and to all our members.
Hi, Vanessa, reporting from Shannon Park. Just wondering what your favourite goal you've ever scored with 1815 is.
My favourite goal that I've ever scored with 1815 has to be on St. Patrick's Day last year, where we were in
St. Teresa's Gardens,
and the ground was unexplainably so spongy and soft.
Yeah, well, the pitch hasn't been played on in years because they closed down the whole housing complex.
And so it's just an empty pitch.
We're in 8, where they have no public pitches, and that's something we should change. Probably the slippiest pitch I've ever played on, which makes sense because we weren't really meant to be there. There seems to be, that they keep updating the ground of the pitch and then forgot. But it was like tarmac, and then there was also some kind of astroturf, and then also there was moss on top of that, and also rain then.
Do you think they should build a hotel at the Michael Mallon pitch?
Look, as much as we'd all love to see another hotel in Dublin City, I think it would probably be better to leave it for the community, because that pitch does get used. We have kids that we've known there for like 5-6 years. You know, some of them turned 18 now, and it's when you just spend that much time at a place, you understand what it means. So, no.
Shocking.
All the action from the 1815 football club there, and the reporter midfield was Vanessa Noonan. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more cultural kickabouts next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.